Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Hurricane Katrina will long be remembered as one of the most powerful storms ever to hit the United States. It will also be remembered for the failure of the government to respond to the damage that resulted. Much of the criticism has been directed at FEMA, that's the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and has led some people to question whether the large number of political appointees in FEMA contributed to its poor performance. We will look at that this morning as a test case, and then perhaps at this larger question, what exactly is the relationship between patronage and performance in federal agencies? And our guest for the program is David Lewis. He is Assistant Professor of Politics and Public Affairs at Princeton University, and in his work looks at the political views of government agencies and their employees, the politics of presidential appointments, and various aspects of public sector management performance. He's written on this, and I just want to mention the titles of two books. One that was published by the Stanford University Press in 2003 is Presidents and the Politics of Agency Design, and another, which is scheduled to come out this year, also from Princeton University Press, The Politics of Presidential Appointments, Political Control, and Bureaucratic Performance. He's talking with us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions are welcome. We certainly would encourage you, if you have questions or comments, to call. The only thing we ask is that callers are brief in their comments, and we do that so we can keep moving and get in as many people as possible. But, of course, questions are welcome. 333-9455 is the number to call if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are. If it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. At any point, if you have questions, you're welcome to call. Professor Lewis, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
We appreciate it. I expect one of the things that people would think right off the bat is that, yes, certainly there are political appointments in government, and that these people are in some of the, can be in and will be in some of the top positions, so certainly in an influence to, in a position to influence policy. At the same time, one would think, well, the government is so big, and most of the people who do the work are, in fact, career people, and they don't really change that much with it from administration to administration. Roughly speaking, I'm not even sure if you could put a number on this, but how many political appointments are there? Or say, what's the percentage of people in the federal government that are political appointments?
Well, there are about 3,000 to 3,500 political appointees in the government, or slightly more depending on how you count it. Percentage-wise, it's a pretty small percentage. We employ probably around 2 million federal civilian employees, not including military personnel. What's interesting, though, about the U.S. is that we have 3,000 to 3,500 political appointees, but other developed countries have closer to 100 to 200 political appointees. And so relative to other developed democracies, we actually have quite a few political appointees, both in numbers and percentage terms. Mm.
And I suppose it is true, I would expect that it to be true, that a lot of these people would be at the top levels of their agencies. We'd be talking about heads and assistant directors and people who really are the ones who have to be determining what the agency should be doing and how it should be doing that.
Yeah, so there are different classes of political appointees, and many people don't realize this. The ones that we tend to think of are people like cabinet secretaries, deputy secretaries, undersecretaries, assistant secretaries, and so forth. But there's a whole class of political appointees that are one or two steps below that level. So they're at either kind of a middle level of management, or they're even in staff positions. So special assistants, chiefs of staff, directors of communications, speech writers, people like that.
Mm-hmm. And we are talking, I suppose, about agencies like the FDA, the USDA, the EPA, OSHA, you know, all the kinds of agencies that really are in a position to look at things like individual safety and workplace safety and quality of the environment and a wide range of things that, in fact, do indeed touch people in very real ways all the time.
That's right. So one of the things that people don't realize, and one of the things that I emphasize in my teaching and in my research as well, is that in the modern period, it's a 20th century forward, the amount of public policymaking authority that's delegated to government agencies has only grown because government work is becoming more complex, the scope of government activity has grown, and as a consequence, Congress can't write detailed legislation in the way that it used to. And so what it often does is says to government agencies, go out and figure out how to solve this problem. And in giving that authority away, they're giving responsibility for substantive public policymaking to agency officials. Now, in the U.S., the structure, so there's we have our 15 cabinet departments, and then we have probably 55 to 60 independent agencies outside the cabinet structure. There's quite a bit of variation across those agencies in terms of how deep political appointments penetrate into the bureaucracy.
This is the kind of thing that people here in the United States have been complaining about virtually since the early days of the Republic. And I suppose people think that it is a given that an elected official, let's say the President of the United States, is in the position to appoint people to various boards and agencies that are that will be in harmony with his worldview and will share the president's agenda. And, you know, for good or ill, it's also a way that supporters are rewarded. Is this necessary? Is it any worse? I guess the question is this any worse today than it was, let us say, 100 years ago?
Well, that's a good question. So, of course, the U.S. used to have an all-appointee personnel system. So this was, up until 1883, the U.S. had a personnel system which was staffed with very few rules at all, often subject to the control of political actors, state and local political officials, what we used to call the spoil system. That system ended because different interests in society began being dissatisfied with the service the government was providing. So they needed mail delivered on time. They needed customs houses to work well to get goods into port and through quickly. And once and the lack of competent professionals in different government positions led them to start complaining and put political pressure on the system to develop a merit system to have continuing professional personnel carry out the work of government. Over time, this system expanded to cover close to 90% of federal jobs. At this point in our history, we're probably actually have sort of a lower percentage of political appointees than we did, say, in 1900, but probably a higher percentage than we had, say, in 1945 or 1950.
Hmm. Well, the central question, I suppose, that we really want to look at, and it's something that you pose in some of your writing, is the question, do political appointees make worse bureaucrats? that is, if there were people who were selected in this manner, do we think that that has something to do with the way that they do their jobs? And then, I suppose, the other side of that is if somehow these people were, if we could construct a system where people were selected purely on their merit, based on their experience and everything that they had done to date, and politics had nothing to do with it. What we were trying to do was just merely select the best person for the job. Then would that person do a better job, and then, in a larger sense, would that agency function better if we had more of those people and fewer political appointees? And one of the things I know you've written about quite a lot is a kind of a case study is indeed FEMA. Maybe we can talk about that.
Okay, sure. So let me just say something sort of briefly about this general question about whether political appointees are worse managers than career professionals, and then I'll see if I can tie it into the case of FEMA. I mean, I think that generally everyone would agree that some level of political control is necessary in a bureaucracy. If it were all run by career professionals who couldn't be removed except on the basis of some sort of bad performance, the government wouldn't be responsive enough to elected officials to make us happy. That is, presidents are elected to get something done. We believe that they should be able to have some influence over the bureaucracy. And so some level of political intervention, control, direction is necessary. The appropriate question is, what's the sweet spot? What's the optimal amount of political control? And what we find is that there's a trade-off in government between having government be responsive, but also having it be competent. And this can be the case for two reasons. One is that sometimes political appointees don't have the qualifications of the career professionals whose jobs they tend to be taking or that they tend to be directing. The other problem that arises is if you dump in a bunch of political appointees, you create systematic problems for management in government agencies. You get more turnover, you make it hard to recruit and retain good career professionals, you get lower morale, and this has systematic long-term effects on government performance. In the case of FEMA, this was particularly evident. So let me just give you a 25-second kind of synopsis of the FEMA story. FEMA was created with a lot of political appointees to begin with. and it only got more political appointees over time. And part of the reason for this is that FEMA was not high on any president's agenda, at least through the 1980s. And as a consequence, FEMA didn't get staffed. Its political appointees weren't chosen by direct presidential intervention, but they got filled according to the wishes of the Presidential Personnel Office. Presidential personnel faces tremendous pressures to satisfy patronage demands from members of Congress, from political parties, from campaign officials, and so forth. And so you get third- and fourth-tier political types that need jobs, and FEMA was a good place to put them because no president really cared that much. As a consequence, you then got bad performance, people who weren't experienced running FEMA until Hurricane Andrew. Hurricane Andrew, Hurricane Hugo, the Loma Prieta earthquake all hit FEMA in about a three-year span in the late 80s and early 1990s. It was a huge electoral problem for the first President Bush, particularly in Florida where Hurricane Andrew hit. And President Clinton got the message. He came in and said, I'm going to appoint James Lee Witt, we're going to cut the number of political appointees, and I'm going to let Witt select appointees that look like career professionals that have emergency management experience. By all accounts, FEMA turns around under Clinton. But over time, this pattern in FEMA kind of comes back, where there hasn't been a big disaster. Patronage-type appointees start working their way back in, so that 10, 15 years after Hurricane Andrew, you see these same patterns developing in FEMA, where there's low morale, where people are leaving, where political appointees are being appointed that don't have emergency management experience, and that hurts FEMA at the beginning of the Bush administration.
Mm. Now, here is a particular case where we can see reasons why FEMA might have had a lot of political appointees, people who perhaps weren't ready to do the job. And as you explained, it was because over time we've either thought it was very important agency or we didn't think it was important agency. So if it was a low ebb, it was at the point where we thought, well, we really don't. The fact that it's going to have to respond to some huge natural disaster, maybe we're not so worried about that. So the idea of how well it can function, it's not high on our agenda. So is this a particular, does it stand out as a particular shiningly bad example of what can happen if you put in a lot of political appointees and that's just something that sort of stands alone? Or are there other examples in the federal government that you can point to that you would say FEMA is not an exception, it's an example of something that we actually see a lot of?
Well, I think that the case of FEMA is instructive because it's generalizable across a larger set of agencies. I think that the experience that we've had in FEMA is not unusual, that there are places in government that have a tremendous amount of sort of politicization, but we don't see the consequences of that concretely, at least in a publicly recognizable way. And they continue sort of persisting in poor performance for a long time. And I could, you know, sort of name some of those agencies, but where they just have a ton of political appointees, they persistently perform poorly, but it just doesn't reach the level of public attention or presidential attention that's necessary to get some sort of reform.
Hmm. Well, what would some other examples be?
Well, so, for example, the Department of Education has three times as many political appointees as other agencies its size. The Department of Housing and Urban Development would be another case. So here are two departments that consistently perform poorly in terms of management evaluations by either the Government Accountability Office, by congressional investigation, by the persistence of tacky scandals, but there doesn't seem to be any institutional will or even performance justification to have that level of politicization in the agency, but it just doesn't seem to matter to folks. Hmm.
Our guest, let me just introduce again our guest for this hour of Focus 580, David Lewis, Assistant Professor of Politics and Public Affairs at Princeton. And this particular issue, that is the politics of presidential appointments and the various aspects of public sector management performance, the things that he's been interested in quite a lot in his writing. And we're looking at this question, is patronage, what sort of impact does it have on the functioning of government? And if we have a particular government agency that has a lot of political appointees, should we expect that that's going to have some kind of impact, or can we actually say that there are examples where we'd say the number of political appointees has some sort of impact on the ability of that agency to do what we expect it to do? Questions welcome, 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. I suppose that here with this particular administration, there has been particular criticism for this very thing. And I imagine also some people would say, I'm not suggesting that you were doing this, but some people would say, well, that's just partisan. That's just people who don't like the Bush administration and don't like its priorities and don't like its attitude toward the role of the government. And so what they're doing is they're just trying to find some reason to find fault with these various agencies and how they conduct business. So having said all that, is there in fact a way, some sort of very objective way that would get us beyond that partisan ideology as a way of saying, well, all right, let's take a particular agency and let's rate its performance in a way that everybody can agree on so that we can say, well, in fact, maybe a particular agency is not functioning well, or people in that agency are simply not doing a good job, and we can document that in a way that goes beyond politics.
Yeah. Well, I want to sort of harken back to something you said earlier in our conversation, David, which was, you know, at some level, we want presidents to have some influence over agencies. And one of the critiques you often get is, well, this is really a Republican phenomenon, the increase in the number of presidential appointees. And one of the things that I argue in this latest book is that it's not a Republican or a Democratic phenomenon. It's a presidential phenomenon. That Republicans and Democrats, when they're in the White House, both have an incentive to politicize certain parts of the government, but they have incentives to politicize different parts of the government. So on the one hand, you get political appointees being brought in just to satisfy these patronage demands. But on the other hand, you get real cases where presidents come in and they think, I want to change policy, but this agency isn't likely to do what I want it to do unless I give it some added attention. So you get Republicans coming in and they say, oh, these social welfare agencies or these regulatory agencies, if they're left on autopilot, they're going to produce policies that are inconsistent with my ideology and what I was elected to do. And similarly, Democrats are going to come in and they're going to say, well, I'm okay with the EPA and with housing and urban development in terms of what they would do on autopilot, but I'm more concerned about the Department of Defense or the Department of Treasury or the Department of Commerce. And so I'm going to try to pay special attention to getting control of those agencies. So there's a sense in which this is really a presidential story more than it is a Republican or a Democratic story. We happen to have lots of evidence in this administration of sort of attempts to politicize the government that have been exposed, but that, I think, can give the false impression that this is something unique to one president or to one party. In terms of the question of performance, you're absolutely right that what we need is an objective way of measuring the performance of federal programs or federal agencies. And so making generalizations from one case like FEMA or other cases can be perilous in terms of drawing conclusions. But there are means of measuring performance across different programs in the federal government. I can go into detail if that seems appropriate, but there are ways of doing it systematically to give us some objective measure of performance.
Mm-hmm. Well, without going into a great level of technical detail, how would you do that? And say again, if we're taking our as our case study FEMA, is there a way to do that and to say yes, in fact, we can make and draw some sort of line between political appointees and their ability to do the job and how they did the job and the overall performance of the agency, and we can do it on a really paper intensive sort of way that says, yes, not only do I just think that that's, we just think that that's the case, I can show you that that's the case.
Yeah, so let me just briefly give you two ways of doing that. So one way that I've done it in this book project is to use these management scores that the Bush administration has put forward. So the Bush administration, as part of their efforts to improve the budgeting process, evaluates each federal program in terms of its performance. And what that means is they send agencies questionnaires where they say, they just ask them about the presence or absence of good management practices. Things like, does this program have long-term goals? Does it have performance measures? Can you demonstrate that the program is reaching these performance measures for the achievement of these long-term goals? And they do this across the government. Now, there are problems in implementation of this, and you might have concerns about bias, but there are comparable ways of measuring program performance both within agencies, so different programs within FEMA, but also across agencies. So you can compare programs in FEMA against programs in other parts of Homeland Security, for example. That's one way of measuring performance systematically. The other way is to ask federal employees. So the federal government does regularly survey federal employees about their work experience and the organization in which they work, and they ask them questions about the leadership qualities of their agency's senior leaders, about how good a job managing they're doing, whether they're being held accountable for results, whether they're being provided the necessary skills and resources to get the job done, whether managers promote communication in the workforce. And these types of questions asked to federal employees across the government give you some sense of what's happening in different agencies at different times. So, for example, in 2002, well before Katrina hit, FEMA was rated the worst place to work in government by federal employees, long before Katrina hit. And that should have given us some sense that, hey, maybe there's a problem here that we need to be paying attention to.
So there are examples where outsiders, people outside of the administration, might point to a particular agency and said, look, this agency is not functioning well. It's not doing what it should be doing. And that even, you would say, even by the administration's own measuring tools, the administration would have to admit, yes, you're right. It's actually not functioning up to the level that we expect and that we would want.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a proponent of the efforts that they've made at measuring program performance in this system that they've developed, and they've tried to do it in a transparent way, and they've made all of this data and evaluation public and transparent and available so that it allows academics like me to come back and produce research that sometimes doesn't show well for the administration in particular areas. And I give them credit for that. I think they've done that process the right way.
But then do they act on that? That is to say, if they have an agency that seems particularly weak and scores particularly low, then do they try to do something about that?
Well, we do have evidence that they've tried to adjust the budgets of agencies on the basis of this information that they've gotten. So they have used the budget as a tool for management reform. I don't have any evidence yet that they've made any other concerted efforts to implement management reforms with regard to these scores that they give programs or agencies.
We have a couple of callers here, and we'd be happy to bring them into the conversation. And we will start with someone who is listening in Champaign, and they are on our line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I'd like to have a little feedback on a couple of them. OSHA, it seems to me that sometimes the strategy that's done is that you sort of starve an agency. And, you know, OSHA is certainly... I don't know what the director was, but he left. But really just wasn't very active. And the other thing, I know that, you know, in terms of the mining industry and all that kind of stuff, the other one was the EPA. You know, you get somebody from maybe the industry that's, you know, pro, maybe business, and you can't tie them up too much and that kind of thing. And then finally, were these people then, in fact, they go back out in the industry and, you know, or, let's see, another example was the, Medicare Part D, but that, I think that was Congress or somewhere. You know, wrote up the program and then went to work, you know, the revolving door, went out and made lots of money. So any of those that you'd like to comment on, you know, feel free to. Okay?
All right.
Yeah, well, there are, for presidents that don't like what agencies are doing, there are a variety of tools that they can use or strategies they can use to get the agency to change. The caller rightly identified a couple of those. One is to starve agencies or programs. So, for example, if you cut the budgets of regulatory programs, the view is that they might regulate less or be able to implement fewer regulations that that might hurt the small businesses or businesses that support the administration. So that's one thing that you can do. The other thing you can do is select particular types of people. So, for example, if you feel like an industry is being overregulated, you appoint somebody from that industry to head the agency to roll back those regulations. And who better to roll back regulations than somebody who has intimate experience with the regulations that are being implemented? So the selection of appointees is another way of getting control. The other thing you can do is monitor regulations more carefully through the White House. You can politicize by adding more political appointees into agencies. So there are a variety of tools that that people use to, or presidents use to get control of the bureaucracy.
All right, let's go to Urbana. This is line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
First of all, I think you picked the right agency to showcase. Congratulations. one of the things, if I remember correctly, to put things in context, as I remember this, Reagan was the first one to take a look at FEMA. Is that correct?
When you say take a look at, what do you mean?
Well, I remember there being a great deal of discussion during the Reagan administration. And if I remember the context, at the time, Reagan was still dealing with, quote, the Cold War. And I thought that he was trying to use that at the time to boost his political position with the Soviets. And if I remember, the context of the actual of FEMA, what it was designed to do was actually protect the U.S. Government so it could function, not really the population, and you know, in case of some sort of a nuclear event. And then as time went on, it seemed to morph into, well, let's protect the public. I think it's always done a great job in protecting the quote, the government, which would showcase your event, but it's lived up to its expectation of not protecting the public.
Yeah, well, the point that you make is an excellent one, that there's always been a conflict within FEMA between civil defense responsibilities and disaster response. So it was the impetus of governors across the country and the sort of lack of coordination in between governors and the federal government in intervening in natural hazards that led to the initial impetus to create FEMA. But as part of the process of creating FEMA, they folded into it all of the old civil defense responsibilities, the types of activities that involved duck and cover drills in the 1960s,
right,
and so forth. And so one of the areas where Republicans and Democrats have consistently disagreed about FEMA is the extent to which the agency should emphasize civil defense. That's the kind of Reagan first Bush view of the agency, as opposed to other types of hazards, or an all hazards approach in the language of both Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton. And so that division characterized the way that FEMA worked in the 80s. So there was more of an emphasis on civil defense, and there are these great stories about one of the heads of FEMA actually carrying a gun to work. That was sort of part of his persona. He liked to be referred to as General. And there was a bunch of security clearance types folks and these types of people, and the hazard people felt somewhat marginalized. One of the reforms that Witt brought in the early 1990s was to break down the barriers between civil defense and the hazards response. But that conflict showed up again when the Bush administration took over. They had more of a concern about civil defense and actually sort of started pushing the agency back in that direction again.
Yes. Is that battle still going? I assume that battle is still going on between the civil defense side and the emergency response. I mean, and it looks like the civil defense is winning out under the Homeland Security versus the emergency response. It appears that to me anyway.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think when the Bush administration pushed the agency back in the direction of civil defense, it was reopening cleavages that had pre-existed in the agency. So when Witt came in, one of the things that he did was sort of break down the barriers organizationally between the different parts, rotate people into different jobs, reduce the number of security clearances, and reorganize the agency so that it wasn't broken down so much on civil defense, hazard response type, those types of divisions. And so in some ways was trying strategically to reduce the tension between those two groups. But the view is simply that, look, if you're going to focus on all hazards, what you mean is you're emphasizing some hazards over others. And for the Bush administration, that meant de-emphasizing civil defense type hazards and emphasizing, weather-related hazards. And so their view was, no, we've got a rising threat. We need to focus more on civil defense and sort of terrorism response.
Thank you for your comments. I'll hang up now.
All right. Thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. And our guest is David Lewis. He is Assistant Professor of Politics and Public Affairs at Princeton University and is interested in the presidency and executive branch politics and public administration. He's done a lot of writing on the politics of presidential appointments. He has a book that is scheduled to come out this year from the Princeton University Press looking at this subject, The Politics of Presidential Appointments, Political Control, and Bureaucratic Performance. And in this part of the show, we're trying to take a look at this relationship between patronage and performance in federal agencies and look at this question. If we have an agency that has a lot of political appointees, does that affect the ability of that agency to do its job? And questions and comments are certainly welcome. Do you think that it is the case that with this particular administration, as I think some people believe, that there have been a number of cases where where the White House has said in a very direct way to some particular agency. The White House has said, this is what essentially has said, this is what we want you to do. Or maybe there is some particular contentious question or something that that agency regulates. And the White House has said, this is the position that you will take. Is there particular reason to believe that this administration has been any more directly involved in doing that kind of thing than, for example, the Clinton administration or the first Bush administration, or the Reagan administration, or any administration?
That's a good question, David. My view on this is that they probably have not done it too much more than other administrations. Where I see the difference is that there have been cases in this administration, of which I can think of probably a half dozen off the top of my head, where relatively junior people have been selected through the personnel process that got into positions of influence where they began engaging in that type of activity. And it's not clear to me that they were directed by the White House to do those things. It's the kind of thing where an ambitious, young Republican conservative gets into a job. They don't have much government experience. They don't know what they can do and can't do, and start trying to do what they think the White House wants them to do. So they try to censor reports at NASA, or change the wording of climate change documents, or they start trying to hire attorneys at DOJ or at the Department of Justice on the basis of their political views, things that are, you know, illegal under law, or at least politically imprudent in the case of censoring reports. That's kind of where I see many of the problems coming. Now, it is true that in this White House, the Office of Political Affairs, the shop that Karl Rove ran, was probably more active in lots of areas of administration than in some other administrations.
Hmm. Just one other thing, and I have a caller here I want to get to. I think also that I think that it's the case, and you can tell me whether this is right or not, that this administration, more than any previous administration, has let long periods of time go by with the top positions of a lot of agencies unfilled. And I think some people have raised the question of whether or not this is a kind of a strategy, because it means that the administration can essentially have things run the way that they want by more junior people that are a few levels down from the very top, and that then the administration doesn't have to fight the fight with Congress to get the people that they would want appointed. They don't really need to do that if they can have the people in middle management essentially running that agency the way that the administration would like to see it run.
I think there are probably cases where that has happened, David. I would also say, however, that it's true that Congress works that way as well. That is, they'll take nominees that the president has put forward, and they'll hold on to those and not respond to them because they like what the agency is going to look like without that appointee in charge. And they'd rather have the career professional who's there in an acting capacity running the agency rather than having the president's person there. But I do think it's true that sometimes presidents will delay in nominating as a way of neglecting the agency so that they don't have appointees in place that can protect, defend, fight for budgets for that agency in the long run as sort of a strategy of neglect or malign neglect.
Is my perception correct that the Bush administration has done this more than previous administrations? I'd seem to think of this as something more true, perhaps in the first 4 years, that there were a number of very important agencies that seemed to go for a very long time without having a head.
You know, David, I don't have any sort of direct recollection of how this administration is doing relative to previous administrations. It's certainly true that there are some agencies that we tend to view as conservative that have had some significant vacancies. I'm trying to. Can you give me a couple of examples?
Well, I guess I was thinking of could have been like maybe the Federal Trade Commission or the Food and Drug Administration.
Yeah, well, there certainly has been this famous case of the Federal Election Commission, actually, so that there were a number of commissioners on the Federal Election Commission, which governs campaign finance and gives out matching funds to candidates and sort of polices campaign violations. There was a period at the end of this last year where it appeared that the agency was not going to have a quorum to even make some sorts of decisions. And so that's certainly a case where you could say, well, maybe, one or the other of the branches doesn't have an interest in having campaign finance law implemented or regulated very carefully.
Hmm. Well, let's talk with another caller here in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, a couple of things. First of all, going back to the Reagan administration and their use of FEMA, I recall that FEMA actually drew up plans to, they didn't call it this in an official sense, but what essentially was prisoner camps to round up literally hundreds of thousands of people because they were concerned about the, you know, building up of resistance domestically against their policies, not only with respect to nuclear arms, but especially their policies in Central America. And, you know, to me, that's a, you know, potential great abuse to do something like that. But at least that was, you know, one way that they viewed the Reagan administration, and some of those people are back in power now, you know, using FEMA as a way of quelling domestic, you know, resistance. But also, you know, a lot of people have said, I think, that, you know, if you don't believe in government, it's hard to have a competent government. And certainly, I think, you know, there's a lot of instances, and I think FEMA is one of those places where, you know, you don't have much of a priority of finding competent people to put in there. If you think that, and there's probably more of a situation with, you know, regulating drugs, regulating the environment, things like that, you know, you don't particularly want to have people that are real competent in there because they're just going to get in the way of, you know, the things you'd rather see do. You know, you don't want to annoy your friends in the corporate boardrooms.
Yeah, I think that there are a couple of things on those comments, which I appreciate, is that there are, I think, pretty well-documented accounts of FEMA internally overreaching in terms of its authority during the 1980s and having continuation of government plans that gave it an exalted role and so forth. The story about the account of the prisoner camps is not one that I'm familiar with, but I do know that there were... that once these plans that FEMA had created and that exalted its role in national crises came to light, they were quite an embarrassment to the administration, and there had been sort of conflicts between the National Security Council and FEMA. And it's hard in this case with the Reagan administration to figure out whether what FEMA was doing was really kind of directed by the administration or, you know, White House people, or the extent to which it was a function of just the poor quality of people that were selected at the top of FEMA during that time and their lack of judgment or maybe their lack of sort of recognition of what FEMA was supposed to do or what it was about. But the types of stories that you mentioned are ones that I think are pretty well documented. In terms of this issue about whether sort of political actors want government to work well or not, one of the problems I think that we've had as a country for the last probably 35 years is that it's easy for presidential candidates to run against government, to say government needs to be reformed or reorganized or reinvented, and that, you know, government is, you know, not going to help you solve your problems. It is the problem. And those types of attitudes brought into government make it difficult to recruit the best and brightest into government service. Generally, and I think have hurt the morale of public service. They've decreased the prestige of it as a profession, and I think have been harmful in the long run in terms of making our government able to do what we wanted to do. Now, it is true that the two parties have different views about what federal government ought to do, and that can affect the strategies they use for governing different agencies. But even in cases where they agree on what they want government to do, the types of strategies that presidents have used or the types of language they've used about the public service have hurt government overall.
Well, you might want to go back and look at that history under Reagan. In fact, I think it was the same director who was carrying the gun to work that you were talking about who was in charge at that time. I remember it very distinctly, and it did make it into the papers because I was involved in resisting the sort of things that we were doing in Central America, involved in the sanctuary movement, and the fact there were break-ins probably by the government into where we had our offices, and things were taken out of files and things like that. So know, you might want to go back and take a look at that.
I appreciate it. That's an account I hadn't heard, but I appreciate the tip.
All right, thanks.
Well, thank you. And we have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. David Lewis is our guest. He is Assistant Professor of Politics and Public Affairs at Princeton University. He has written a lot about American politics and public administration and management. He's particularly interested in the politics of presidential appointments. Has a book coming out this year from Princeton University Press, The Politics of Presidential Appointments, Political Control and Bureaucratic Performance. And questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222. 9455. Going back to an idea that you talked a little bit about near the beginning of the conversation, the idea that we do, when we elect a new president, we do, at least some people have the idea that they're going to change things, and that if the they should have the ability to appoint new people to direct federal government agencies, because if the bureaucracy essentially was the same, then that would limit the president's ability to make any changes. So, as you said, the question is, well, where's the sweet spot? Where is the place between having the right number of political appointees so the president can, in fact, make the changes that he or she has in mind, and at the same time retain enough of the bureaucracy so that you have a pool of people who are experienced at doing their jobs. So, and you, then you hold on to some kind of institutional memory. What, do you have any kind of idea? How do you even find where that spot is? You know, much less have some influence on, I don't know who it is that, whether that's, this is ultimately it's the Congress that puts some check on what the president can do. Or do we have to rely on the administration itself to have some sort of sense that there is this balance point?
Well, I guess let me start with the last point first there, and that is that in many ways the large number of political appointees that we have in the U.S., Congress has been complicit in that process. Some of them they benefit from. So, for example, there are still a number of agencies that have regional offices or regional positions that are Senate-confirmed presidentially appointed positions, and that's a legacy of the spoils period, where members of Congress wanted control over the selection of personnel in their regions or states as a way of both controlling how law was going to be enforced there, how government policy was going to be brought about, but also as a source of patronage for the local party. And what's true is that Congress has been much more enthusiastic about presidential appointments when they share the same party as the president. Mm-hmm. And it's usually only during these periods when the majority in Congress is a different party from the president that they say, let's, you know, hold on a moment here. So what can Congress do? Well, Congress has at various points written into law restrictions on the number of presidential appointments that can be in any given agency at a given time. So they'll say, no amount of this money shall be used to pay for more than 100 presidential appointees. So they can, of course, write into law restrictions of this type. On a more general level, this question of how do you find the sweet spot in terms of performance, it's a difficult question. I think that I think it's pretty clear that we've gone past the sweet spot in the U.S. for a variety of reasons. And I think that we can make a move back in the direction of fewer political appointments cautiously, and I think that there are ways to do that based on evidence that we have. So, for example, we know at the program management level that career professionals tend to do a better job or get better evaluations by this administration than political appointees do. So that level down deep into the bureaucracy, we have pretty good evidence that maybe career professionals should be doing the day-to-day management of federal programs. So that's one place to look to cut the number of political appointees. We might also look at places where government has thickened over the last probably 20 or 30 years, where the hierarchy has gotten more extended. Those are places to look as well. We know that thickening has poor consequences for government performance, that the more managers you get, the more miscommunication there can be, the slower things get done, the less accountability, and so forth. And so that's a place to cut. And then there are these what we call ministerial staff, political appointees that don't have managerial responsibility generally, but are in staff positions. So they are directors of communications and public affairs and speechwriters and special assistants and chiefs of staff. Those positions have proliferated over time. And I think we could safely cut some of those positions because in many agencies, the exact things they do are done by career professionals very effectively. Now, just to be fair to presidents, however, if you do that, you're going to limit their political power, right? Because we tend to think of patronage as a bad thing and only a bad thing. But presidents use patronage shrewdly to hold coalitions together, to pay off political debts, to keep their party in line, and to, in some ways, govern more effectively. They're sort of an important source of political capital. So we can cut the number of political appointees and perhaps improve executive branch or government performance, but we are going to limit the tools that presidents themselves have to get certain policies moved forward in government.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I find myself wondering is, and this is, one hates to pick on FEMA. Maybe it's such an easy target there ought to be some sort of way at least to make certain that people who are appointed to head these agencies have the qualifications and the background to direct them. And here was a particular case where it seemed that the Michael Brown, who at one point was the head, was far, far from qualified to be running an agency like that. One wonders, didn't anybody... And again, it may reflect the fact that at certain points people thought FEMA just wasn't that important. But you have to wonder why it was that somebody didn't say, well, shouldn't we really have somebody who's actually had some kind of background in dealing with big disasters and emergency response? And the fact that his most significant prior work experience was with the International Arabian Horse Association, maybe it wasn't the best kind of thing to have on your resume if you're going to run an agency like FEMA.
Yeah, well, your response is similar to the response of the Congress in the aftermath. So there were a couple of pieces of legislation put forward to have requirements attached to public safety positions and FEMA in particular. Let me just say a couple of things about that. The first thing I would say is that at the time that Katrina hit, no senior emergency manager in FEMA had previous emergency management experience, except one person. That was a career professional serving in an acting capacity. So they were just holding a place for a political appointee until that person came back. And so at some level, the effects of a Michael Brown would have been mitigated had the sort of larger management structure of FEMA been more populated with people who had emergency management experience as well. The difficulties associated with a Michael Brown only get compounded when there's no corrective. And my view is that federal management works best when you get political people who bring in a generalist, responsive, you know, sort of energy to a new administration, but they're confronted with career people who say, well, what about this, or what about this, or this is how things work, and that can be an effective synergy. And FEMA didn't have that, and so it's not as simple as Michael Brown. It's sort of a more systematic problem. The difficulty we get with writing in specific requirements for the backgrounds of people like the head of FEMA, is that many people would be qualified under these exact background qualifications. So Michael Brown's a great example. So we say, well, how could he get into this job in FEMA when he only had worked for this horse association? Well, he was originally brought into FEMA as the general counsel, and he was a lawyer, so arguably he at least on paper had qualifications to be the general counsel. And then after he'd worked in FEMA for a while, he got moved over to deputy director. And you could say, well, somebody who's the general counsel has an idea about how FEMA works, and so being deputy director doesn't seem like that far of a stretch. And then after Joe Albaugh, his predecessor, left, who's the natural person to take over as head of FEMA? Well, the deputy director seems like the natural person. And so you could arguably say that he met the qualifications that were being considered by Congress for this exact position in terms of the amount of experience he had in emergency management, because he'd been in the agency for a while at the time that he took the head. He had presided over some natural disasters, apparently effectively. So those requirements aren't the cure-all that they appear to be, and I think the solution to these kinds of problems sometimes requires a little bit more attention to the whole management structure as opposed to just the person at the top.
Mm-hmm. I guess it's interesting, if I'm as I'm going back to this idea that, you know, you ask why were there so many political appointees in FEMA? Well, it was because we have people that were supporters of the administration that needed to have jobs, so we needed some place to park them, and they parked them there because they didn't really think FEMA was all that important. It seems sort of disturbing, the notion that that one way of telling what an administration thinks is a really important agency or not an important agency is their willingness to stuff it with political appointees.
Yeah, I mean, it's the kind of thing that's interesting because it's not as if the White House said, oh, we don't think FEMA is important, right? What they said instead was, here are the key 85, here are the key 95 positions that we think are really important to move forward the agenda of this administration. And so they're focusing on, you know, the Secretary of Defense, and they're focusing on the Secretary of the Treasury, and they're focusing on the Education Department because they've got No Child Left Behind. And they're really focused on the positions that they think are the most important for moving their agenda forward. And the process of selecting those people is incredibly rigorous. That is, there are professional recruiters brought into the White House. They canvass broadly for these important executive positions. But it's by neglect or just oversight that these other positions in government get filled, and they get filled by this other process that is in some ways unconnected to that professional recruitment process. And, you know, from the White House's perspective, they think FEMA seems to be working well. It seems to have worked well for a while. There hasn't been a natural disaster in a long time. There was nothing in FEMA's recent history that would sort of bring it to their attention in the way that it had been brought to Clinton's attention in 92.
Yeah. Well, there we're going to have to leave it because we've come to the end of the time. If you're interested in reading some more on this subject, you might look for the forthcoming book by our guest that I mentioned that will be coming out this year from the Stanford University Press, Presidents and the Politic... No, I got the wrong title. The Politics of Presidential Appointments, Political Control and Bureaucratic Performance, indeed, from Princeton University Press this year. And then you might also look at Presidents and the Politics of Agency Design, also this published by Stanford University Press, 2003. Our guest, David Lewis, is Assistant Professor of Politics and Public Affairs at Princeton University. And Professor Lewis, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.